begin our session on perfect parenting and other myths. I'm Catherine Bosch, and I'm a certified family life educator. I work as a family life educator at a counseling service, a family service agency in Kitchener, Ontario. I've done it really for over 25 years in various places such as Syracuse, New York, Amherst, Massachusetts, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and now in Kitchener.
What is your family situation?
My family situation is that we have two daughters who are now age 24 and 27. Our 24-year-old was here last week for 4 days with her fiancé. Our 27-year-old is in Scotland finishing her research for her dissertation for a doctorate in linguistics at the University of Chicago. So you can survive. My gray hair is not a result of having two children at the age of 24 and 27. It's strictly genetic. I had gray hair before I was a parent.
One myth that brings to mind that I think is once the kids are 18, you don't have to worry anymore.
Okay, that's another one. We've been talking a bit about myths, the kinds of information we heard about the role of parenting either before we became a parent or that we've learned something differently about since. Some of those statements are, children should be seen and not heard. Teens are terrible. I'm glad to hear you say that's a myth. That's encouraging. My child will be, fill in the blank, clean, perfect, studious, obedient, etc. at all times. After the first child, the rest will be easy to raise. And that you raise kids the same as, I'll raise my children the same as I was raised. And if we don't believe that, our parents will remind us of it. A couple of others I have is spare the rod and spoil the child. My kids must obey me or I've failed as a parent. If my kids get A's in schools, that's because I'm a good parent. As your parent, you owe me respect. Kids never listen to what I tell them. Bad kids do bad things. Good kids do good things. Well, we could probably go on and research a lot more myths to the whole idea of perfect parenting. But I think the perfect parenting itself is a basic myth. We aren't perfect people. I think that's why we have forgiveness, because they know we aren't going to be perfect. And that's a marvelous gift to know about. The super parent is often defined as that perfect person against whom we compare ourselves in order to experience failure. When we compare ourselves to someone, don't we often compare ourselves to somebody who's way out there or really is a professional or really is very much involved, spends their whole life training to be the best golfer, the best swimmer, the best whatever, and doesn't really spend much time doing much else. Well, sometimes the myths that we've heard about parenting can be rather discouraging. That we have to be perfect parents, that my self-esteem depends upon how well my kids behave out there on the green. Well, that's an awfully big load to put on your child, that they have to be responsible for how I feel about myself. Can you imagine that? That if I were to put the responsibility for my success, my feeling of being okay, my okayness, on whether my daughter got a doctorate or not, or whether my other daughter succeeded in her business or not, and if they didn't, that meant I was a failure. Not because they changed their mind, or because business has its reverses, or that they chose to do something else, but that I was a bad parent. Well, that's an awful load to put on them, and it's a rather risky place to put all the eggs that I have in their baskets, saying, I will be as what you make me be. Well, it's the other way around. I'm the parent. They're my children. So instead of burdening them with a heavy weight of the responsibility of making me feel okay, we might look at what kinds of things we as parents do in the encouraging or discouraging of them. And I venture to say, when we see a child who's out of control, we're not very happy about it. But we don't have to blame ourselves and label us, if I were a better parent, then my child would be that perfect one, would always be properly behaved at all times. That's a little bit too much to expect. So I want to focus primarily tonight on looking at encouragement, discouragement. Because I think that's the basis of a number of issues in the whole parenting game. Whether we feel encouraged, whether we feel discouraged, whether how we encourage or, without being conscious about it at all, how we discourage our children. What is it that makes you discouraged in a day? What, any time in these past several weeks, or that you know you've experienced in some past time or that you have heard from others, you can always say, I have a friend who, if you'd rather not talk about yourself. I have a friend who always gets discouraged when. One of the times I get really discouraged is when I make a statement and someone says to me, who says so? As if I've got to have three people standing behind me to back me up. My word isn't enough. What are some other discouraging things for you as adults? Or people that you know?
When I don't get done the things that I intended to do that day.
Okay, whether it was a realistic list for the time period you had or not, or whether it was realistic and there were just so many things that came in at the last minute unexpected that were more important. Okay. Just not accomplishing what you want to accomplish. What else makes you discouraged?
When one child wants to be right all the time and arguing with another.
Okay, that's probably two of them. When a child always wants to be right, has to be right, has to be the first one there. And whether it's connected with that or whether it's separate, always arguing. I want to get my way. I want to win. That's discouraging. Probably discouraging for both. The person who has to hear it and the person who's involved in doing it. Some other discouraging experiences, causes.
I feel discouraged when my worth is based on what I do and not what I am.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. When people began to judge me according to what I do rather than who I am, that I'm a child of God, that I'm a person of worth, that I'm lovable and capable. But then they've got to see how many things I've accomplished along the way. Anything else? As a sub-point to that, I noticed on the listing of all the teaching staff on the board, it just lists me as a family and life educator without any additional background. I'll tell anyone who wants to know afterwards, but I won't make it as a public statement. And I wonder how many people look at that and say, well, does she really have the credentials to do this kind of thing? You know, what's my background? Okay. What else is discouraging?
When there are parts of the family chores, like taking out the garbage or setting the table, which I have said something earlier in the day, it would really be helpful if one of you would do that or mention one of them because of the help. And then coming home really tired and not seeing the garbage taken out or the table set. It's a small thing, but I think I'm working so hard, and then I get discouraged.
And what are they doing? They're just playing all day. Yeah. Okay. When you feel that there's been agreement about accomplishing something, taking responsibility for something, and you come back and you find it's not been accomplished, it's not done. These are discouraging things. Some other things that are discouraging may also be when that table isn't set, I come in to my house and I say, again, didn't you remember again? I thought we made it clear that table was to be set by, and you never remember. How come Mary always does it whenever I ask her to do it? But every time I ask you to do something, you've got to challenge me. Never. Just once I'd like to. Anyone feel encouraged from hearing me say that? No one? Why do we say it? It's a wrong question to ask. Why do we say it? Another question might be, what am I really feeling? A more helpful question might be, what am I really feeling when I see something that's supposed to be done that isn't done? What am I really feeling? And how clear was the contract? How clear was my request? Or did I say, that table better be set by the time I come home, or we're just not going to eat? And it becomes a challenge. Well, do they really mean it? If I don't set it, won't we eat? What will really happen? I don't know if you see the cartoon For Better For Worse in your papers. Lynn Johnston is a Canadian, and I think has done some marvelous things. I'm not sure it's a comic. I think it's an education in itself. One of my favorites of hers is when she says to Lizzie and Michael, "You get up in bed by the time I count three." And they look at each other, and they're peering around the door, and Mom says, "One," and they look at her. She says, "Two," they look at each other. She says, "Three," and she's standing right in front of them, and they're looking up at her with wide, wide eyes, and she's looking down at them. In the next square, she's saying, "One?" You know, or else, what's the consequences? We can talk about, we will talk a little bit more about the natural consequences of the social order, of the natural order. We'll talk about logical consequences of the social order as one area that we might focus on. But I'd like to go back a little bit more to the discouraging and encouraging aspects of our parenting role. That has, I think, a very, very great bit to do about how children respond to us. What is it that they feel? In my self-esteem course, I talked about the balance in the emotional bank, the goodwill bank. What's the balance? Is there a greater amount of criticism in there or a greater amount of appreciation and recognition in there? Notice I'm not using the word praise. I'm uncomfortable with it. You may be very comfortable with it. But in my mind, praise is so closely attached to good boy, good girl, I feel uncomfortable. If that's not the way you attach what you attach to it, fine. As long as it's looking at helping a child recognize their contributions, not the necessarily the finished product and how perfect it is, but that they're even beginning, that there's a welcome, there's a working together, that there's a cooperation, that there's even that beginning recognition of, yeah, I can do something, and I will. But the amount of appreciation, recognition, encouragement that we have in that bank between each of our children and myself goes the same way for adults as well. What's in that goodwill bank between the adults as partners or adults as co-workers or adults as friends? And how can we build that balance of goodwill? One of the assignments I give to each of my parenting classes on the first session is to take a piece of paper and to write at the top of it acceptable behaviors. Halfway down, I ask them to write the label unacceptable behaviors. And then say, take some time during this week, whether it's an hour, an evening, a day, or whether you want to try it for the whole week. But just become aware of what are some of the things that your children do that are acceptable to you, even if it's as small as, good morning, Mom, or bye, Dad, and gives you a hug or some other recognition, or picks up the paper and hands it to you. We often take that for granted and say, that's what they should be doing. I'm not going to give them praise for that. And what we do come down on them instead is, pick up that paper. You didn't say good morning to me. Aren't you going to say goodbye? And that's a challenge that says, I can never do anything right. So why bother trying? So it's an awareness exercise. Be aware of what your children do that what are their actions, what are their comments, what are their statements that are really acceptable to you? You want to encourage it. And what are those things that they do that you are not so happy about, that are not so helpful? And they'll say, I'll need 3 pages for this down here, and I can do with 2 lines for this up here. And I'll say, the next class, okay, how many of you did it? And which has the longer list? Most of them, 99% of them basically, unless it's been a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good day, will have a longer list on the top and saying, you know, when I look at that, I'm aware that they're really not as bad as I thought they were. The second point that comes is that they'll say, I'll write something down here on the unacceptable list. And the next morning I'll look at it and say, why did I write that down? That's not really so bad. I most often let them do that. What was happening with me that I happened to write this down last night as unacceptable? Well, as I said, it's an awareness exercise of how we may change, how we look at things, and to really be aware of more of the positive, helpful, encouraging things that our children do that can encourage that I'm okay feeling, I can do it feeling, and yeah, mom, dad, think I'm okay, I belong. And that belonging is one of the most powerful urges for all children, for all people. We want to belong somewhere. And if we don't think we can belong and be accepted in our family, we'll find another family somewhere. It may be my peer group. It may be in fantasy somewhere. But it'll be someone that will accept them. It may not be the kids that you want them to be accepted by, but they'll find someone that will accept them if they don't feel that they're really accepted and belong at home. Isn't it Robert Frost that wrote the words, home is where when you go there, they have to take you in? Well, I've had some different mixed feelings about that. You know, one is sort of good news, and the second, it's sort of depressing. They have to take me in. I want them to be able to take me in. I want them to want to take me in, not have to. I want to belong. We all want to belong. So children will find ways of belonging. Who discourages children? That may be the wrong question to ask. What might be a more helpful question would be to ask, how does a child become discouraged and at what price? Well, we spoke of some of the things that discouraged us. What do you think it discourages children? What do you think discourages children? Yes?
And expectations that are too high set by the parents.
Okay. Unreachable expectations. Or they think they've reached the expectation that the parent wants, and then the parent has already moved it up a couple of steps without them knowing. What else? Yes?
I think when their feelings aren't taken seriously and when they're not listened to.
Yeah. Two important ones. When their feelings aren't taken seriously, the child says, I'm not tired. And you say, oh, yes, you are. What it really is translated as is, I'm tired and you have to go to bed. Children who feel that they aren't listened to. How often when a child comes home from school, what's the first thing a parent will ask them?
How was the day?
How was school? What'd you do in school? Too basic. What'd you do in school or how was school? And if they start telling, we start working away at something. And then they stop telling. I do a parent effectiveness training class, and one single parent mom in the class said she had a 4-year-old. And after some sessions, she said, I've really been worried about my 4-year-old who just won't talk to me. So she decided to practice some of her active listening skills of really tuning into what her child is saying, even if they're not saying anything. And the child came in from playing at a neighbor's, and mom said, did you have fun? Child didn't say anything. So mom said, doesn't sound like you really want to talk about what's been going on. Child didn't say anything. Mom said, you really don't want to talk to me right now. Trying to identify that silence. And the child turned to her and said, no, because every time I talk to you, you turn and walk away. And a bright light went on to this mother, saying, because she was aware that coming home from work as she did, she had a bunch of things to do. And so when the child would start talking, she'd turn around and start making supper. I can hear a child behind me, but a four-year-old doesn't recognize that. Four-year-old's awareness is, you look at me and I know you're listening, but if you turn away, you can't hear me. Because that's sometimes what they do. They want to turn away and pretend that they don't hear you. So they think it works with the other way around. So the mom picked her up and said, I'm sorry. I guess I thought you knew I can hear you, even when you're talking in the room. But it's important to you for me to look at you while you're talking, and let's sit down for 5 minutes. Supper can be 5 minutes late sometimes. And she said, this week she's been a chatterbox. Sometimes I want to turn around and walk away so she'll stop talking. But she said, that was such a relief because it was such a gap between us. Okay, so children can become discouraged when they don't think we're listening to them. How else do you think children become discouraged?
When they feel they don't fit in with their peers.
When they don't fit in with their peers, that for some reason they don't like me, or I can't do things as well as they can. It's maybe partly their perception, partly what they have come to realize and recognize as I can't do it perfectly. Everybody expects me to do it perfectly, so I guess maybe I won't even try, might be part of it. Or they just haven't learned the social skills to deal with that particular group of kids. So you feel sort of left out, not accepted with that peer group that you want to be a part of. Why else might kids be discouraged?
Getting defensive responses.
Okay, they say, well, I really wanted to set the table, but when I came home, the door was locked and I forgotten my key and I couldn't come in. Or they might say, Jimmy down the street lost his cat and he asked if I'd go out and help him find it, so I've been combing the neighborhood for his cat. And you say, excuses, excuses, excuses. You know that you were supposed to set that table. Mm-hmm. And you could have said, I have to go set the table first and then I'll go, you know, that we don't really understand them. We don't understand their reasoning. We won't accept the reasoning. And they can build, and particularly when they're in the age where reality and fantasy are sort of mixed. And sometimes they will tell some stories because they really don't distinguish the difference at that time. It's so close together. And we need to help them make that difference. Understand the difference. Okay, I could imagine also that children can feel very discouraged when they complete something. They bring home a paper from school and it may have 2 wrong on it instead of 18 right. You know, why do we emphasize what's wrong instead of emphasizing what's right? Or the paper says, messy paper. What's a messy paper for that teacher? Well, it may mean you didn't keep your margins even. It may mean you wrote very quickly and your words ran together. It may mean you erased some things that didn't get completely erased. You know, it's just too general, not specific enough to be helpful. What about when, as a child, can you put yourself back into being a young child, an early school age, or even a preschooler, and others are doing something that you may not really want to do. It may be a 4 or 5-year-old and you go to the playground and all the younger kids are swinging on swings, and maybe your supper didn't settle very well and you just don't want to go up in the swing. And your parent says, come on, look at all these other little babies. They're braver than you are. Why can't you swing just like the rest of them? How would you feel? Encouraged? Pardon?
Discouraged.
Discouraged. Put down. Misunderstood. Boxed in. I'm not okay. Give up. I'm never accepted. Misunderstood. Okay. So when we look at children. Look at little children, for instance, all the little ones that are around. If you were down at that size, what is your picture of the world? What do you see?
Knees.
A lot of knees, a lot of crotches. You look up, you'll see armpits, the bottoms of chins. So here's this world, as someone referred to, with 97-foot-tall giants who weigh 765 pounds and whose voices can boom. And here I am. I'm going to get squished by them. I've got to be careful. I've got to, you know, it's a frightening kind of thing. And if they look down at you with a frown on their face, you know, that's really quite discouraging. I'm not okay. And then parents, these giants, these huge people that look down on them, ask impossible questions. Like, why are you so slow? Why did you stumble?
Why is it so hard for you?
Why is it so hard for you? Could you answer those questions? Could you, as a 4 or 5-year-old, answer those questions? Can you say, well, my cognition isn't fully developed in the such and such and the such and such, and my right and left brain are not quite distinguished? And, you know. Well, they're not very capable of that. So sometimes we learn to ask the wrong questions instead of recognizing what they may be feeling at that particular time, and that they may be very embarrassed at having stumbled or having forgotten. We forget to. I say my memory is at the end of a pencil, but I just have to remember where I put that message. So we ask them some impossible questions. We look like giants to some of the little kids, and sometimes we feel like little ants in front of some of the teenagers that we have who are much taller and bigger than we are and who seem to have a lot more power. I think there's a lot of things we teach our children without having any awareness that this was on our schedule for the day. I don't think there's anyone who wakes up in the morning and says, how can I make Timmy miserable today? Or how can I teach him not to listen to me? But sometimes we do both of those things without really being aware of it. And we end up being very discouraged, having children who are very discouraged. Child's basic goal is to belong, and sometimes that belonging is at any price. If I can't be the best at being good, I'll be the best at being the worst. And so if somebody's a goody two-shoes in the family, you'll have somebody who's the imp, the outrageous one. If you have somebody who's shy, you'll have somebody who's very outgoing, very extrovert. If I can't be the best at being this, I'll be the best at being that. And when we do comparisons, that's also rather discouraging. Children need, Rudolf Dreikers said, children need encouragement like plants need water. And you're aware of how often the sprinklers go on out in the village here. Well, we need to be that aware and that encouraging and that nourishing, that watering to our children with encouragement statements. So instead of saying who's at fault or who's to blame then for why are children discouraged, we might look at what purposes does their behavior serve, and how do we contribute to this problem? I think there are 4 basic reasons why children misbehave. This goes back to Dreikers again. And you're probably aware of that. And the first one has to deal with our need to belong. And if our need is to belong, we have a basic goal of having attention, getting attention. Anyone ever have children and have the telephone ring and not have children at some time during their lifetime interrupt you on the phone? That's when they need you the most. It's when they got to get your attention. The second one is power. And when you begin to feel the effects of power, it begins to change, and the next goal becomes one of revenge. If you're going to use your power on me, just wait, I'll show you that I can use it back on you again. And they'll find ways. And then the last one is assumed disability. I can't do math. You always said you were poor at math. It must have come in the genes. You can't expect me to do well in math. or I can't do that. That's too hard for me. I don't know how, even though they've done it many times. And we can't, all behavior has is purposeful and designed to provide a general sense of belonging. So when their mistaken goals are ones that are to get attention, and a discouraged child will search for attention, an encouraged child will work toward respect. How can I respect others and gain their respect? By being cooperative and helpful. The opposite of that, the mistaken goal of power from the discouraged child for an encouraged child will be to take responsibility. I can do it. Yeah, I'll give it a try. If I can't, then I might. It's okay to ask. I can't get this part of it done. What am I doing wrong, or how can I go about doing it? With regard to acts of revenge, an encouraged child might work toward responsiveness. How can we work together on this? And with assumed disabilities, the opposite of that would be toward working toward resourcefulness. Well, this isn't working right. How can we figure it out? Things going wrong, let's figure out what the problem is. And they begin to learn at an early stage problem solving, which is a skill that will last them a lifetime. It's what adults basically use in a good amount of their relationships, or I hope they do. How can we solve this problem, whether it's at work? We don't use physical force or temper tantrums and such at work. We try to figure out a solution to the problem. If children fail to acquire a sense of belonging through socially useful, cooperative, contributing actions, they'll settle for belonging at any price. Belonging by attention getting. The whining, the fussing, the pulling on you, the demanding. By no, I won't, even when it's long beyond the two-year-old stage. And the no serves an important purpose for the two-year-old of helping that child to understand who I am. It doesn't serve as much of a purpose for the older one except to get their way. Getting back at revenge or assuming disability so that I can have an excuse not to do something. When children use these mistaken goals of attention, power, revenge, assume disabilities, it's because they've lost the courage to find their place by doing something useful. They recognize that if I keep at this, I can end up getting attention. Maybe negative, but negative attention is better than none at all. Kids won't continue to do what doesn't work. They will continue to do what does work. So if they keep tugging, whining, fussing, and they end up getting your attention, that's what they'll do the next time. Even if on occasion you don't give in to them, that's okay. Yeah, because they know that often enough it works right for them. So even if they don't succeed once, I'll try it again, because most of the time I do succeed. So going through that checkout line where the supermarket people knowingly put all the goodies for those kids when they've had to sit in the car to walk around with mom, whatever the age is, I see it happen with preteens and teenagers who are with parents in the grocery store. They'll get to the checkout and they'll say, "Mom, how about some candy?" "Well, no, we're not buying junk food." "Come on," and they'll have an adult kind of fussing until mom says, "Okay, stop it, and just take one," and then they'll end up with two. Children become discouraged in basically two ways. One, they make an effort to contribute, and the adults discourage them by failing to acknowledge or appreciate either their attempt or their completion. They may go through setting the table, but it's not right. "Don't you remember the glasses go on the right side, not the left side? Or did you forget the spoons and the napkins?" You know, that rather than saying, "Hey, there's something still missing," and let them figure out what it is. Or, "I guess we're not going to be fully able to eat our whole meal tonight. I wonder if you can figure out what we still need. And let them help, let them learn how to think. One of our basic roles as a parent is to teach our children how to think, not just what to think. Can you think how often we tell them when they're of adequate age to figure out the problem, hey, something's missing here, rather than the spoon's dummy. Second part is that adults often rob children of opportunities to overcome adversity. We do for children what they could do, should do for themselves. We discourage responsibility taking. How many of you have had kids who have forgotten a library book at home on the day it was due back at school? What do? Child calls from school and says, Mom, gotta have my library book. Can you bring it to school? And so we run over to school and drop off the library book. Or if it's due at the city library, we'll run it in and we'll pay the fine for them and say, next time you get that book in or you're going to have to pay me back this fine. Next time we still pay the fine. Next time we still pay the fine. So instead of saying, gee, I wonder how you're going to handle that. They may have to experience the natural consequences of it. I guess this week you won't be able to take a book from the library. Or how do you suppose you can solve it? Maybe the child says, if I bring it in tomorrow, can I pick up a book tomorrow? And the librarian says, well, okay. Or the librarian will say, no, this is the only day your class comes down. Or if it's overdue at the city library, the child takes some money out of an allowance. Well, let me just digress for a moment on allowances. That may be another one of the parenting myths, that we pay, kids will do jobs if they're paid for them. They probably will, but when they get enough money, they're not going to want to do any more jobs. Or the price may have to go up for them to continue to do the jobs, and pretty soon you're offering them a car to wash your car. I'm of the opinion, and you may disagree with me, but that's okay. I'm just throwing out choices and options, and it's your choice. It's your responsibility to choose what will work for you, what may be beneficial. It may trigger some other idea that will work even better for you. That allowances are to teach children how to handle money. I don't get paid for doing the supper dishes or sweeping the floor or vacuuming the rug. You don't get paid for it either, I venture to say. Why do we pay kids to do it? When they live in the household as part of the family, it puts them as a separate species of the family then. Not, they're in but not of the family. So we want to teach children how to handle money. That's why they get an allowance according to their particular need at their particular age. Yes?
Yeah, I agree with you totally. And just to validate what you said, an interesting anecdote was when I was reading something about Nelson Rockefeller and when he had his two younger children by Happy, that even though when he was vice president he would, and traveling, when he'd get home, he would gave his children quite small allowances, like $3 or $4 a week, but he always made them keep books and to show where the money went to, because that was the purpose of the allowances, for them to do planned spending and saving and learning, teaching them to handle money. And his theory was, if you can't teach them when they're little, how can they, how are they going to make it on a budget when they're older?
Yeah, important. Thanks for sharing. That we start fairly young, and that we may set some basics, that some of it is to be saved, some of it is to go to charity, whether it's to church or food for the world, whatever the possibility, and some that they can spend, that they need to have some access to something that they can make decisions on, and they can make some decisions how that one sum is divided into those three possibilities. So that if they do have to pay a library fine, they may have to take it out of their own savings or what they were going to spend for candy that week or going to the movies or whatever. That's taking responsibility. They experience the consequence of their action. They experience what their remembering or non-remembering causes. As when this discouragement accumulates, children become increasingly irresponsible. So we've got discouragement, and then we have that lack of responsibility. All people need and will work to get power some way. And if they feel discouraged, they will work in very negative ways to find how to get that power. In sibling rivalry, for instance, if they feel that there is someone in the family who has the favored position, they will try to work to get some power, either by being the worst at being the best at being the worst, or trying to get the best, who's the best, into trouble. And then we tend to compare, well, why aren't you as good as? Why can't you behave like so-and-so? Which adds even more fuel to their fire that says, I'm not okay. I don't belong. There is nothing, there are very few things, I'll leave a little opening in the door. There are very few things that need to be said with a comparison to someone else. In most cases, you can deal with a child without any reference to anyone else, how they do it or don't do it. You can speak specifically and directly to the child. I'm discouraged about how often the library book gets left at home on library day or gets remembered too late to be taken back to the library, rather than, why can't you remember it like everybody else? How many other kids in your class forgot their library books today? I don't think that's helpful. If we want to add and make a nice pile of discouraging remarks, we can keep on saying that. But now that you know that it's not the most helpful in building encouragement and building responsibility, we can find other ways of dealing with it. Looks like you've got a problem about library books on library day. How do you suppose you can solve it? Not how can I solve it for you, but how do you suppose you can solve it? That's getting children on the way. If they're old enough to be in school, they're old enough to think. That's putting them on the way of learning how to think, not what to think. Instead we say, okay, I'm going to put a big red mark on the calendar. It's Wednesdays that you take your library books, and I'll remind you every Wednesday, you've got your library book. Did you get your library book this morning? To say, how do you suppose you can remember? If the child suggests a calendar, oh, that's okay. Where can you put the calendar? And what do you need to put on it? Is there anything else that might be helpful? Where is the best place so that you can remember? And give the child the responsibility.
I was just going to ask, what do you do if you ask that and the child shrugs his shoulders?
Oh, why do you suppose that? Thank you. That's an important question. That is a good question to ask. And why do you suppose the child shrugs his shoulders? What do they know is going to happen? You're going to solve the problem. You're going to be told what to do. So why should I think? You'll think for me. I won't have to bother. You've got an idea already, and that's what you want me to do.
It's quite from a child's point of view, but I get the impression that some parents like to actually run around and do all these errands for their children because it makes them feel better about not listening and doing all the things that they do.
And being the martyr, okay. That it may, from the point of view of the child, it may not be so helpful, but it may fill a need for the parent. And in that case, we need to recognize that we are being a millstone around the neck of our child the more we try to take responsibility for them rather than letting them take responsibility when they can. That we want to teach them what to think and also put our own self-esteem level onto them, that they have to make me feel okay about myself. No one can make me feel anything without my permission. If I want to feel happy, I'm going to have to decide I'm happy. It doesn't matter what my children do or my husband does or anyone else does. You know, I have to feel okay about myself to be happy. I don't want to wait until somebody else pushes my button because they don't know where it is. I don't know where it is. I mean, it's inside. When kids will recognize very quickly that more often they say, shrugging their shoulders, I don't know. And they'll continue to do it for a while, and we just need to be a little bit more patient than they are and to say, well, let's think about it. Maybe you're not into thinking about that right now, but give it some thought and let's come back, after supper? What's a good time to talk about it later? Get some ideas. To let them know that you really are counting on them and you feel that you believe, not just think, you believe they can come up with some good ideas, and that they can solve a problem. And sometimes they come up with marvelous problems. I like the story of the young child who came home from school and said, he was about a first, second grader, and he said, the friend of the bully in the third grade just came over to him today and said that he's going to beat me up after school. The bully is going to beat me up after school tomorrow. And the mother thought immediately of calling up the school, the teacher of the class, and the principal, and checking out who's the bully, and calling his mother and so forth. And she decided to think, and she said, well, what do you suppose you can do? And he said, I've got a couple of ideas I've been thinking about as I came home from school. And she said, tell me about them. And he said, well, I thought I could put my glasses on. She said, he wears glasses, but he doesn't like to wear them. He needs glasses, but he doesn't like to wear them all the time, so he keeps them in his pocket. So I could put my glasses on, but if he's really a bully, it probably wouldn't matter. He'd beat me up even if I have glasses on. So then I thought, I could try to talk him out of it and to tell him that fighting really doesn't solve anything. I said, anything else? He said, well, yeah, I thought if those two things didn't work, then I'd ask my friend Billy, who's as big as he is, to fight him for me. But there'll probably be something else. And Mom said, okay, it looks like you've been doing some real thinking about this. And she said, I forgot all about it. And then in the middle of the school day, I thought, oh, should I really call the teacher? Is this going to happen? Is he going to come home bloodied? So at the end of the school, he came bouncing in, not a tear on his clothes. I mean, looking as neat as a kid can at the end of a school day. And she said, well, it looks like you've had a pretty good day at school. How did things go with the proposed fight? And he said, oh, he didn't show up. So sometimes we can really take over responsibilities when our kids can be fair. There may be times we'll recognize that, and we need to really listen enough and carefully enough to our child to really recognize if there is a serious issue there that is more than a child of that age can handle. Well, back to who's to blame, which is the wrong question. And instead we might ask, how am I feeling and reacting and reinforcing the kind of behavior that might discourage child is seeking? So we might look at the feelings that we have. If I'm feeling annoyed, frustrated, or fatigued, irritated, it probably means my child is trying to seek attention. That somehow or other, that level of attention that he's received, she's received, is not sufficient. And the child is feeling, I belong only when others notice me. That's a mistaken goal. If I'm feeling angry and defeated, I probably know I'm in a power play with my child, and my child is feeling that I belong only when I'm bossed and do what I want to do. And sometimes we might recognize that for ourselves and feel that I get into a power situation with my child because I want to be boss and I want the child to do what I want the child to do when I want to do it. There may be some times that this is important. We have to leave at a certain time. We may have to give that information beforehand. But we're back to that, what's the balance in the goodwill bank that says, okay, we do really have a time commitment here. I won't fuss and say, no, I'm not going to go, or I've got to play and I've got to do other things. You know, Mom does things for me at times. I'll be willing to cooperate with Mom on this. If you're feeling hurt or wanting to hurt back, then you know and you're bound up in the mistaken goal of revenge. Where the child feels, I belong when I hurt others and hurt them as much as I hurt. Or if you're feeling hopeless, at a loss, that you know you're in a power, you're in a play with a child in an assumed disability. Where the child is feeling, I belong as long as I'm not confronted with my inadequacies. There's a positive side of this also, as I said, respect, where the child feels, I belong when I get respect from those I respect. Responsibility, that I belong when I'm responsible and I'm given the opportunity to be responsible. responsiveness. I belong when I can love and help others as much as I've been helped and loved. I can share back. Resourcefulness. I belong when my talents are accepted, nourished, and developed. I can be accepted even with my beginning talents. I can work. Sometimes in working with discouraged children, we need to give up control. Not give in. Anything you want to do is okay. Forget it. Just get out of here. That's giving in. That's giving in. We may instead need to give up and pull ourselves back from the power play and take another look at what's really happening. Cool off a bit and say, we've got a problem that we really need to solve. Often, eating problems, picky eaters come from panicky parents. Food problems are often because we want to control how much and what they eat rather than providing them with some choices, letting them have some control and some decision-making power. That doesn't mean I let them have a hot fudge sundae for breakfast. If they're not into, they're not supposed to eat ice cream, I probably shouldn't have ice cream in the house. If they're into a lot of junk food in the afternoon and I don't want them because it spoils supper, I probably shouldn't have junk food around for them to get into. It may not be any better for me than it is for them. So sometimes we need to check on what we're tempting them with. It's important to also deal with the behavior, the specific behavior, rather than label the child. You're always the forgetful one. That's labeling the child. The table is not set. That's describing what's been forgotten, and that's describing the problem at hand, and allowing them some opportunity to see if they come up with an idea as to how to solve the problem, rather than saying, set the table. That still is better than set the table is better than saying, can't you ever remember? What am I ever going to do with you? You're just so, and then put a label. Labels disable. I'm not sure they're ever helpful for kids. When we use the word, the label bad, it strips the child of dignity and worth. So we really need to separate the deed from the doer. Whenever we're feeling a sense of hopelessness or a sense of helplessness when they have an assumed disability, we need to fight the feeling and not succumb to hopelessness. Because that's discouraging to both the child and yourself. Your child comes home from school and says, I can't learn these French verbs. And you say, come on, let's sit down. And the child says, I can't. And you say, oh, yes, you can. Here, I'll help you go through them. I just can't do it. Forget. And you say, oh, here I'm giving up on my time and you're not willing. Forget it. I don't know what I'm going to do with you. Then we're both hopeless. And we've reinforced, see, now mom's even given up on me. Rather than saying, boy, it's rather difficult. What might be helpful to you? What would be the best approach to it? Do you want to think about it a while and we'll come back to it later to see what ideas you can come up with and give them some room. Sometimes to deal with it right now might be too much. Sometimes we tend to do too much for our kids and we treat them as if they're nobility, the king and queen. And when we do that, what we often teach is the development of no ability. We need to have kids recognize that they can accomplish things in their own right and get feelings of acknowledgement, appreciation, encouragement from doing it. Part of this is also on discipline. The difference between discipline and punishment. I'll actually go a little bit more on that next, I believe later in the week when I do a course on how to talk so kids will listen. I want to take just these last couple of minutes and look at some strategies for encouragement. Children will take advantage of the advantage, so we want to give them the most positive advantages to take advantage of. One of the statements I like is to take your wind out of their sails, and that is don't argue. The more we argue, the more entrenched and enmeshed in the whole issue we get, and it's not helpful. Sometimes it's just better to say, Let's talk about this later when we both have a little more chance to think about it. Another important saying is to say what you mean what you say, and do what you said you were going to do. Say what you mean what you say, and do what you said you were going to do. It's important to have faith in the child, that we're not asking them something that's beyond their ability, and that you can do it. If you have some difficulty, feel free to ask. To separate the deed from the doer, we mentioned that a little bit earlier, that we need to accept our child as being capable, as being lovable. We all need to learn some new things, and we can encourage that development of new abilities. We need to appreciate the effort, not wait for the whole project to be completed, and to notice contribution rather than perfection. Often we wait, well, is that all you can do? Is that the best you can do? Rather than saying, well, you've gotten through it. What have you learned from it? How else can we deal with it? We want to be able to listen. We'll deal with more with that when we in the course on how to talk, so kids will listen. We want to show that appreciation, show that encouragement, so that we have children operating out of for the positive good rather than out of the negative. Our children are a lifelong investment. They are our personal heritage, but not our possessions. You can never possess a child, but we can support them, we can be a model for them, we can teach them, we can lead them, we can guide them, we can encourage them, and help them find wings to manage on the way for their life ahead. Any comments or questions? We're really close with the next course, next session coming up. Last minute comments, questions? Yes.
Well, there's been a cycle of discouragement, or a child has become discouraged over a period of time. What's bringing these things into action that you're talking about? How long does it take? What kind of hope do you have?
Depends upon how old they are and how discouraged they are. And you might start with saying, some things just aren't working. I wonder what we can do about them. How can we pick up the pieces and head out more positively? I don't like being discouraged, and I don't want to discourage you. And I guess we've probably fallen into the habit of doing it without really realizing the effect. But now that we're aware of it, what can we do? And how can we support each other? I think it's being open, doing some problem solving, praying about it, working together on it, not being discouraged if the first thing you try doesn't work. Well, that's, we tried. What can we learn from it, and what can we build from it? You can't learn less. You can always learn from your mistakes, unless you just want to blame the other person and bury your head in the sand. If you don't want to do either one of those, we can learn something from it that will help us in the next step. Yes?
I'm wondering if this can sometimes be overdone, too. I have a daughter who has said to me, well, you don't have to thank me for doing that. It's just something I wanted to do.
Okay.
So I consciously have tried to be affirmative. My wife can comment on this further if she wants, but I've gotten that reaction at times, like, you're overdoing it, Dad.
Yeah, and then you take a note from what your child is saying and say, what would be helpful? And you might go back to them, get some further information from them. How do I know when it's enough? How do I know when it's too much? How do I know when it's not enough? Can we set up some kind of system so we can talk about it? Open the lines of communication. Might be very interesting to find out what their ideas are. Well, who comes next? Thank you very much. Thank you.